The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Actually, I want to thank everybody for coming here this evening. And I think it's a great testament to Rabbi Cohn, what a remarkable visionary he is, that we can create this kind of an experience for our families. And all of a sudden, we have grown up in our community and we realize that there are so many influences on us in terms of the culture, that being strong, observant families by itself is no longer sufficient when our children wander the world outside and they are subject to other kinds of influences. I'm going to speak briefly, maybe 15, 20 minutes, just to give us a frame of reference for the kinds of concerns that I speak to in our presentation. And then we're a small enough group where hopefully the dialogue is going to give you actual take-home points so that you could leave this evening and say, okay, here's a strategy and it's going to work for me. And that's hopefully my goal. So, quick frame of reference, just a way to broaden our view and understanding of this. My name is Barry Wolanski, by the way, and I'm the executive director of a counseling center that's been in the community 40 years, and I've been the executive there 35 years. And we work out of a family systems model, and there are 25 of us professionals, and all we do actually is we think about, research, write, teach, and work with these cultural issues that are of such concern to us. And I've come up with a frame of reference, a way of helping us understand just how complicated it is really in our culture. And the best example I can give you is an example from my own childhood in Brooklyn. And talk about something that actually sort of floats over most people's consciousness. We don't really think about it. And that is the behavior of gambling. Growing up in Brooklyn, gambling was not an acceptable behavior. Pas nicht. We didn't do that. We didn't go to the racetrack. We didn't go to casinos. We didn't, you know, play poker for money all night. Forget the Mahjong game. Forget, you know, the Pinochle game. But we didn't gamble we didn't have internets then, but we didn't gamble as a way of life, like the worldwide poker tour. Except maybe, truth be known, my grandmother, once a year, she took an Irish sweepstakes. That was it. But in America, the shift in the behavior is something that we're all exposed to. If the mega lottery, Powerball, or the lottery goes from, you know, 50 million to 75 million, it's the lead article in the newspaper. You hear it on the radio. If you have a television, it's the lead article in the news broadcast. That all of a sudden, people are made to feel there's something wrong with you if you don't get on the road and drive up to Connecticut and get a Mega Ball ticket. You know, for 20 million, we sit, we don't go. But if it goes up to 100 million, we should already go looking for it. It's shifted our thinking. A dollar and a dream, that's what we really need. You don't need hard work. And betting the lottery has become a patriotic responsibility of all Americans. And the shift in the behavior to gambling behavior has created some very, very profound effects in American culture. So much so that you take Sports Illustrated. Sports Illustrated has a cover story on poker. As if poker has become a sport in America. Now, why do I say that? I say that because of an issue around science. And the issue in science is really simple. We have learned in the last 15 years or 20 years just a wealth of information that was not accessible to us until we had PET scans and MRIs and CAT scans. We began to see brain development and the neurology and biochemistry of the brain differently once we had instrumentations that allowed us to look at it. And what did those instrumentations teach us? It taught us that children were different than adults. And specifically what we learned really was about a part of the brain that monitors impulse, the occipital region of the brain, and that communicates with the median forebrain. That's a place where we have information stored and data and knowledge about issues, so that when you're struck with an impulse, you know, and you're an adult, the neural pathways between these two parts of the brain is like the Lincoln Tunnel. Straight to New Jersey from New York, it's well lit, it's ventilated, there's no problems. But in children, it's not such a straight and direct pathway. It's circuitous, it's labored, there are obstacles in the way, and you can't get there so fast. So what that sort of demonstrates to us is that children, when struck with impulse decisions, make decisions in a less clear way, a less strong way than adults. Adults think differently than kids. Now, I just want to present this hypothesis and then we'll go right to questions. Now, what does this mean for us? It means that as a science we understand children as different, but if you look in the commerce of the American culture, they are dedicated to marketing drugs to children, because they also know the science. And for example, when you look at the drug nicotine, the active ingredient in tobacco, the tobacco industry, multi-billion dollar industry, knows the following. It's very hard to get somebody 20 years or older to make a decision to start smoking cigarettes, because they make good decisions. But it's very easy to get a child to do that. They have a science, and they have statistical research and analysis, and they know demographics, and they know gender differences, and so on and so forth. And what they can tell you is that about half the population that picks up nicotine and uses it's going to walk away. They'll smoke a couple times, choke, walk away. The other half is going to smoke again. And they know, by the nature of the drug, that nicotine establishes tolerance, that smoking one cigarette is not going to be enough eventually. They'll smoke two. Smoking two is not enough because it's tolerance, you'll smoke four. And eventually, you'll end up being addicted. And of the population that becomes addicted, of that half of the population that tries and stays with it, 87% never stop and stay stopped for five or more years. The vast majority of people who become addicted to nicotine struggle with that drug from the time they start till the day they die. The vast majority. Let's talk about that for a second. One, we know children make impulse decisions and they don't make good decisions. Two, we know that if there's a marketing group that targets children, we can get them to establish brand loyalty, we can get them to consume that drug. Now, something becomes very important in understanding this. Certainly by Torah, we're not permitted to harm children like this. But in the marketplace, you know, J.P. Lorillard, Philip Morris, they can make decisions to actually look for children, get them to use, help them use in ways that say, I'll stop, I could stop anytime I want because they're only smoking one or two cigarettes. Or I'm going to stop when I graduate high school. Or they're going to say, I'll stop when I get married, knowing full well it's highly unlikely that that's going to happen. Now, here's a paradigm that I want you to think about. The average child who smokes, consumes nicotine through, let's say, smoking Marlboro. Marlboro Red has approximately 24 milligrams of nicotine per administration. They freebase the chemical, they turn it into a gas, they inhale it into their lungs, it goes from their lungs to their heart, one pump, it goes to the brain, bypasses most of the cells in the brain, have no interest in nicotine. Some cells love nicotine. It adheres to the cell, osmosis inside the cell, and changes the chemistry of what that cell does. Follow all that? That's what any drug use is about, psychotropic drug use. Any drug use changes the way the brain chemistry works. Now, if you're smoking 10 Marlboro cigarettes a day, you're using 240 milligrams of nicotine. In the language of our culture, what we usually say to our children, and when we talk about cigarettes, we say, oh, you're smoking a half a pack a day? That's disgusting. But do you hear a difference when I say, oh, you're using 240 milligrams of nicotine a day? When you say you're smoking 10 cigarettes a day, that sounds like a bad behavior. If you say you're using 240 milligrams of nicotine a day, that's the truth. It's addiction, it's drug abuse, and we don't want your children to think of it along those domains. And we don't teach this, even with all of our strategies trying to get people to quit smoking. We don't teach this model because that's really going to frame the issues in the most direct way. This is about a chemical dependency. Now, you take nicotine, we teach it to children, we target children. Then you take, and nicotine, by the way, is the leading cause of death in America. Leading cause of death, 241,546 people every year die from nicotine use as a primary cause. And the second leading cause of death in America? Alcohol use. Nicotine is controlled by the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, right? Not the drug administration, not the Food and Drug Administration. So public policy is not about medicine, it's about social behaviors, which is misleading. Same thing with alcohol. The only time alcohol was controlled as a drug was 19th Amendment, and then doctors needed to write prescriptions and you got it in the drugstore. The truth of the matter is, lots of people can pick up alcohol, use it, and walk away. They don't have problems. In fact, it could be the simcha. You say a bracha, you stay conscious, you say a second bracha on a second drink, and that's where your limits are, and you can enjoy the mildly euphoric chemical effects of alcohol as a drug. But the way the American culture markets to children is a goal to establish brand loyalty. And you ask any of your yeshiva students who are 16, 17 years old, ask them what their favorite beer is, and they'll tell you. The scientific fact is alcohol is a chemical that you can begin using safely by 21. Before 21, because of the brain maturation issues, you can't really make good decisions. You shouldn't be drinking. But we market to children. That's why we have little cartoon characters, little frogs that talk to kids and try to teach them brand loyalty to Budweiser. But if you look at any of the commercials, whether they're on television or they're in pictures, you see a particularly American concept, and that is conspicuous consumption, abundance. It's not a beer that people are having. There are 10 beer bottles on the table. It's a jug, a pitcher of beer. It's not one glass. So we're teaching them volume, not a beer. So the marketplace teaches children to consume alcohol and consume it in abundance, and they don't get DWI on their bicycle, and they don't have problems, you know, with showing up to work drunk when they begin using. And the same thing is true with nicotine. They could still play sports. They can still, run around the block 3 times and consume nicotine. So they know, somewhere in the back of their mind, that the use of these substances are dangerous, but their practical experience is the lie. I can stop anytime I want. I don't have a problem. And the paradigms they use to think about the nicotine or think about the alcohol are lies that America tells people, which are, this is the way you're supposed to have a party, lots of alcohol. This is what kids do, you smoke cigarettes. Now, one other piece I want to just bring out, it's important. The University of Michigan has been doing a Monitoring the Future Studies project for decades. And what they're really looking at is attitudes and beliefs about substance use from parents and from kids. And one of the interesting phenomena that we began tracking in the last 10 years is that when you looked at parents who were 40 years or over, they did not expect their 14-year-old to smoke pot. They didn't expect. If you look at parents of 14-year-olds today who are younger than 40, they expect their kid to smoke pot at 14. We have, in the American culture, shifted the paradigm to create another substance that we don't call a drug. We call it, it's organic, and made it acceptable. Now, as a psychologist who practices addiction medicine for 35 years, I want to tell you something. I've never met a person who has this illness that didn't start or begin in adolescence. So now we have a terrible conundrum. You have a culture that markets alcohol, nicotine, they use it with impunity, now has incorporated another substance, and that's before we even go to a more global notion, and that is if you have a television or have watched a television in the last 3 years, you know that 43% of your commercials, approximately, are brought to you by the pharmaceutical industry. We have medications for everything, and we market these medications. And, you know, thank God that we live in an era of science where we have medications that can help with many significant illnesses. But the concept that we're marketing on television is that everything has a chemical resolution. And most people in this room could probably name at least three sleep medications that are marketed, right? You know the one with the butterfly? You never saw a television commercial? Ambien is not the butterfly one. The luminescent butterfly is Lunestra. Right. And then you have the other one where the guy wakes up from his dream. He walks into the kitchen. Abe Lincoln standing in the corner. There's a deep sea diver and a gopher playing chess. And, you know, they say, where have you been? Rosarin. So what concerns me is that we market medications, but we don't say, why is America having trouble sleeping? And what are the alternatives to people who struggle with sleep disorders? What are we looking at? And we're not looking at a half a dozen other ways that won't feed the marketplace, unfortunately, ways of managing sleep disorders or other common concerns. We're teaching medication. And what happens with a culture that does nicotine, alcohol, marijuana, now better living through chemistry, how do you spell relief, D-R-U-G-S, what happens is that kids grow up with a mindset, a cognitive frame, a construct embedded in their thinking, a way of thinking that's different than anyone who's over 40 years old in this room, different than the way you grew up, different than the way you think. And what happens is that it has shifted in this culture in such a profound way that 15 years ago when a yeshiva in Cleveland wanted, quote, drug expert, they asked my mother, and they chose me, they flew me in the middle of the night, drove me to the yeshiva in tinted windows, never announced to the parent body that I would be speaking, put me in a room with parents, locked the doors so that I could bring a message about this, and then flew me right out of Cleveland so that nobody would ever think that the yeshiva had a drug problem. But now tonight, thank you, Rabbi Shai Cohn, we're able to talk about this in a different way, but even now we're understated, we're afraid to walk into a room that talks about drug and alcohol. So we put it in the little corner of the workshop. But it's the leading problem in our families where we have adolescent children, because onset is in youth. Half the people walk away, they don't have problems, the other half die and have tragic outcomes before that and live tragically with families. And it's so hard to see because, as Dr. Madeline Levine, who's really been on the circuit talking about this, she just published a book called The Price of Privilege. One of the things that we're looking at is the at-risk kid is not the child from a dysfunctional family, not the abandoned child, not the poverty kid, not the kid from a divorce home. The at-risk kid is all of us. And she's done some remarkable research in the Ivy League schools and demonstrates the incidence of depression, the incidence of self-abusive behaviors, the incidence of drug and alcohol exceeds that of other state universities. So the at-risk kids are all of us, and we really need to understand and accept that and make it safe so that we can address in our yeshivas and in our synagogues, we can address this problem in a way that can prevent, truly prevent, tragedies from happening. This is all very young. I had a dialogue with somebody who I think just left the room before. 15 years ago, you could smoke in a restaurant. Public policy began to shift because we understood the profound impact on our health care. You know, we pay our health insurance costs are sky high for mostly for the reasons of nicotine use. Because people die from that, and they end up spending vast sums of insurance monies in the last days of their life from the drug problem that they develop and can't cure. So we began to change public policy, and we're going to need to do that in our communities, with our kiddish clubs, with the way we celebrate often, and with the sort of customs and traditions that have grown up around Simchas Torah and around Purim and around Farbrenyans and around how the yeshiva community really just looks at nicotine and alcohol, because we need to understand that it is now intimately connected with drug use across the board, and you can't really avoid looking at that problem safely anymore. So I'm going to stop because there may be some questions. We have a half hour, I think. We can have a wonderful dialogue. Please.
Is the problem. We're all here, and the people that are here realize it's a problem. First of all, could we try to understand what's driving these kids? Besides, I'm sure it's just not just the television that they saw on television. What's driving these kids to start smoking and to drink? And I'm not talking about just study, I'm talking about Irish by Kiddush. Once, and I saw three boys, high school boys, pour themselves a cup like this. Went over to the father just to make him aware that his son just did that. I mean, I'd say, why are they doing this? And once you understand why, I imagine you will be able to understand how to address the problem and how to get them to stop.
Why are we all drinking? Why are you drinking taps at a kiddush shachar? I think that's a problem. I just had a bar mitzvah for my son. There was nothing, no alcohol, no nothing. Somebody walked in with Grey Goose. I didn't embarrass them, but why is it okay for you to sit and have schnapps after, you know, shots after shots, and not, and they're seeing this as an example, and then we say, oh no, but not you, you're not allowed
to. So let me frame it for us in a way that directly answers this question, and this is an important dialogue. But the answer, I don't think, is there a door? Sure, we could shut the door as long as...
better that way.
Okay. I hope they have air conditioning on. This is very important, and it's a hard concept, and it answers the question across the board. It's sort of like my question, why is America having trouble sleeping? The answer to the question is this. Nobody inhales a cigarette and inhales the nicotine and says, I can't wait to get cancer. Cardiovascular disease, emphysema, upper respiratory infections, bronchitis, pneumonia. No. People are using nicotine for the benefits. What are the benefits for the use of nicotine? Well, certainly when you just start, if you have sub-thresholds of dopamine levels, nicotine stimulates dopamine. Dopamine makes your heart race a little bit. It warms your core body temperature. It makes your muscles relax. It focuses you. It's a wonderful feeling. But if you continue to use, you become addicted, and the benefit for using nicotine is you avoid withdrawal. Withdrawal is nasty. You're agitated, you lose focus, you're irritable, you're tense, you have body aches and pains, distractible, this is very bad. If you could administer a nicotine and restore the blood plasma level of the drug, then it's okay. So the answer is, we ignore consequences, and we use for the benefits. And the truth is, the benefits for us is life is very stressful and complicated until you learn how to celebrate life that's very difficult and complicated and stressful. So one of the things we're not doing in our community and in the yeshivas and possibly in our own homes or probably in our own homes is we're not demonstrating how to take care of ourselves, manage the stress in our life, deal with the suffering in our life, and be besimcha at the same time. So that the effect is candy's dandy, liquor's quicker. We can't manage the culture. And it's shifted in the last 1,000 years, you know? And then again in the last 100 years, and probably in the last 10. It has shifted in a way that we are anxious and fearful. We can't have enough. We've bought into dreams that are not our dreams about what you need to be okay. And I deal work in, we have offices in Syosset, Merrick, Woodmere, very affluent communities, and people who have more money, make more money in a year than I'll see in my lifetime, and they're worried that they don't have enough. So the answer, the paradigm, is people use drugs for benefits, never consequences. And when children are feeling enormous stress, and they are in profound ways different than you and I did when we were kids, they need more to be successful. You know, you need more. We didn't have a car. We didn't have a television, let alone a plasma TV and a Mercedes. We could do better than our parents. We had an American dream we could live by. Our kids don't have that, and we have just really distorted their worldviews, and they expect so much in their life. And that agitation and that edge is an emotional, physiological event in the body, and you give them a cup of schnapps, and it's better. We don't teach spirituality. We don't live spirituality. We don't model the spirituality. You know, Shabbos isn't really what Shabbos could be for most of our homes. You know, it's the stress of two people getting home from work in time to put a meal on the table that we got from their zones. And, you know, we had such difficult days about what happened at the office that we're, you know, if you spend a few minutes talking Torah, it's a few minutes. But it's not really the joy of it. And then you go to, shul in the morning and you have three vodkas before, you know, Shacharit is over. And then you come home and take a Shabbos nap. And what are our kids learning? It's very complicated.
I would think that I'm probably an average family where life is stressful and dealing with our suffering and whatever. Assuming I'm average, where I have all those things, and I try to juggle coming home before Shabbos but having the right atmosphere, I still have a teenager who I think, you know, I would hope that I could help prevent all these cultural draws, plus his own new tensions of, like, all the things that you discussed. But he has this world out there, and there will be a kiddush that has drinks, and there is the draw to be with the guys who can be man enough because they're adolescents, they want to be the adult, right? It's the kid who's not really allowed to become, let's take the extra shot. And I would love pointers on if there are any. I won't be able to give him, in the short time that I have, the whole way of remanaging his stresses and life, you know, dealing with all the positive. I try in my life. I want to know if there are concrete things, like I asked you at the beginning.
Yes, there are concrete things, and I don't want to minimize them. And they're the simple things, and you know them, and these are your take-home points. This is what you have to work out with, because it really is ultimately simple. Firstly, pas nisht. Remember the Monitoring the Future studies that said the erosion of boundaries and parents expect their kids to do something? Then they do it. We don't do it in this family. It is not acceptable. And just saying a clear boundary doesn't mean they're not going to test the limit, doesn't mean they're not going to do it. But when they do it, they'll have something that those other Monitoring the Future families don't, which is your voice in the back of their mind saying, my mother's not happy about this. That's profound. We have lost a conscience in America. Everything is acceptable. And that's why you have such, really, what used to be deviant behavior. And that's why I began by talking about gambling behavior, which we have changed as a sociopathic behavior into... Why is World Poker the lead story in the cover of Sports Illustrated? Is it a sport? That's so principal and so primary. Pas nisht, we don't do it in the family. Secondly, I can only speak for myself. Driving home for Shabbos, when I had my kids in the house, I drive around the block four times before, just to get myself into the space that I knew I needed to be and wanted to be to bring Shabbos to my children. Otherwise, the workday is enormous. So I'm proud of you, and you could teach us, how do you get, as a working mother, how do you get that spiritual focus and bring to them in Shabbos what you need? And you got to work hard at it, because when you can't let it shift the first time they press you and start complaining. Okay, so modeling behavior. We don't drink, we don't smoke, we don't serve, you know, the first thing when somebody walks into the house, you bring out a bottle of schnapps. We don't party that way. And I'm not saying you never do that. I'm saying you're not modeling that behavior for your children. What a profound prevention. And then the positive aspects of spirituality. How do you show children that life has tragedies in it, and yet we have faith? That terrible things happen to families, all of us in this room, no one is spared, you know, an illness in the family, of tragic loss, a setback, even the loss of our fortune, to say, but I have a bench, I have a table, I have food we can get in a community that surrounds us, so what, I don't have marble in my bathroom anymore. How do you show that you could live without those kinds of accoutrements? So that's a profound prevention strategy. And then ultimately, I quote Jacob DeBaker, who said this to me, and I thought it was brilliant. He's a brilliant man. And after complaining for a while, he said, I was complaining to him about life struggles, and he said to me, Barry, prayer is an answer when there is none. Sometimes that's what we have left. You pray. You never give up on your children. You never stop hoping that they're going to make good decisions. You never excuse a boundary of something that is posnish, that they're not allowed to do that, and you look for help. Then as a community, there are lots of things we need to be doing with our community, with our yeshivas, with our shuls, about bringing public policy into an era of science in understanding what has gone wrong in the experiment in the American culture and in the culture of science. You know, science is a fascinating, thank God, wonderful phenomena, but every once in a while they come up with, whoops, I'm sorry, take the drug off the market and everyone else is going to die from liver disease. Who used it, you know? We have to understand that we have faith in God, not just the pharmaceutical industry. So we begin to look at public policy on a national level and on a synagogue level differently. And we begin to shift the culture so that it's not acceptable to smoke in restaurants anymore, and it's not acceptable to drink. And when your son says, that the real guys are drinking, you can say, give me the names of your four friends, and we're going to have a meeting, and all the families are coming to our house. We'll have a coffee clutch, and we're going to talk about this. And it's the dialogue. It's not going to happen. You have take-home points from today's meeting, but it's not going to happen if you think it's just the seven things Wolanski said. It's an ongoing, continuous dialogue in the community. Thank you, God, for Rabbi Cohen, who's creating that dialogue in a way. But this room should be filled. And we should stay until next Shabbos, and maybe we'll get somewhere. Please.
If we, all of us, in our yeshivas, and every place, if we could be totally convinced that HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists and that he wants the very best for every individual human being, right? Would that make for eliminating some of the problems that we're talking about?
Who could argue with the notion when the Messiah comes, we're going to figure this out?
This is what I wrote about on that paper.
That's a very wonderful and sweet concept.
Half, I speak about that somewhat, and that we mechuyev to teach our children this. If not, we haven't begun our obligation in chinuch or anything. And the last half is my debate with an atheist on those basic concepts.
I look forward to reading it. Please.
He's speaking about his pastish. Very specific question. A child on the fringe. Not yet at risk, but almost there, hanging out with kids who he shouldn't be. Comes home dead drunk, Simchas Torah. His mother wants to tell him, you should be ashamed of yourself. This is despicable. They should have left you in Shul, not brought you home. Father says the kid's in a lot of pain. Let him be. Don't be too hard on him. What do you say?
Two things you should never do. Never give coffee to a drunk, because then you get a wide awake drunk. That's not a good thing. And never talk to your children under the influence of drugs and try and help them understand.
I mean after.
Okay, after. One of the wonderful skills that we have as parents, which we overlook completely, you know, you could tell a 9-year-old almost anything. And the way their brain functions, They're very concrete. You say something, they'll accept it. All of a sudden, in 365 days between 12 and 13, the brain starts changing and children question. And they question everything. And the power of their thinking is really what intimidates us. And that's a parenting strategy we don't use a lot of. My shift with my kids once they became adolescent is I stopped lecturing. That happened every day before their adolescence. And that's what you do when you're teaching the values and beliefs of our family and of our traditions, and you're instilling that and inspiring that. And then when they're 13, you want to start asking. And what you're doing when you're asking, and this is rabbinic, I mean, this is what the great rabbinic teachings are about, is how we learn. When you're asking a question, you're monitoring how they think. So this young man who came in drunk on Simchas Torah, I want to know what he was thinking. And the one question I ask when I do assessments on chemical dependency disorder of kids, how'd you make the decision? I could say, you know, drinking that is bad, but hopefully somebody already taught him that. But I am going to say, how did you make the decision? What's he going to say to me? That's sort of what you were saying about the community. Okay, so tell me, what did you learn from it? 5 minutes?
Okay. You want to close?
Yes. What did you learn from the experience? What does it say to you? What do you think about alcohol as a drug? What was the value to you?
One drink less next time.
Yeah, you know, what if
only
they
one
give me
yeah.
No,
only
if,
one
if I can talk from personal experience, I have a son who is at risk, who has been through all of these things, self-abuse, alcohol abuse, etc., which we're still dealing with, and that's part of why there was no alcohol on my son's life, but not his son, not that son, a different son. And we were at a bar mitzvah this past Shabbos at a kiddush, and there was liquor on two tables, so my husband stood at one and I stood at the other. Because it's not just my son in the neighborhood who is drinking, and nobody watches. And I beg of you, if you're in a shul on Simchas Torah or Purim, and there is alcohol, somebody has to be a shomeret, okay? Because, yes, there are men and they are drinking, and they're serving as an example. And Bachram, who get really badly, you know, abuse it. And that's what the boys are seeing. That's what your young 8, 9...
So you're talking to the notion of policy and how we present those traditions as a community and some prevention. But you're talking about the kid who...
My son, on last year, on Purim, got absolutely, totally drunk. And I have a dialogue with him. He has a group of friends. They called me to come get him. And I came, and I'm telling you, I couldn't drive 10 feet before he had to lean out the door and crash. And it took me to go a mile, about an hour. And the dialogue that I had with him, he said to me, I know I drank too much, okay? You're not going to change them in a day. It's a dialogue. That's the important thing. You have to start a dialogue with them about alcohol, about trusting. I tell him his most important asset that he owns, that he carries with him, is his integrity. And it's his level of honesty with me. Because once he breaches that and he's not honest with me and things go badly and he doesn't do what he's told me he's going to do, it's going to be a very long, hard climb back up to where I trust him. And that's one of the hardest things as a parent, is yes, they've breached your trust and you've taken away their responsibility, so you cut off, you can't go here and you can't go there.
That's very sage advice, if I can just interrupt, because we do have to end, and I do want to That's sage advice, it's wise advice, and most importantly, be prepared for an ongoing dialogue
right.
over the next several years. But the specific question too to answer, it is the adolescent's almost obligation to challenge your boundaries. So he is going to say, ah, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, so what? Don't accept that as truth. Hear it and know that he doesn't really mean it. He's challenging you, but he's also hearing you. Parents have far more influence over children than a peer group.
Really?
Than a peer group. When they need to make significant major decisions in their life, it's not the peer group that they're going to check. When we can shift this alcohol drinking phenomena into a medical issue, they'll always come to the family for the medical advice. Always. They won't say to their friend, what surgery should I have? They'll say, Abba, Ima, what am I going to do? But so expect your child to challenge you. The statement that follows is, okay, next time I'm not going to drink so much. No, this family, I do not expect you to drink. It is not acceptable. And, you know, if you come home drunk, that's another story. So we're paying attention. So he learns not to get that sick. But he comes home drunk. Now I'm seeing a pattern. Now I'm saying, okay, I've already defined a boundary. I already know that some people drink and it progresses into a life-threatening illness. So if I see this as an ongoing behavior, I'm going to seek consultation. And we have to find the right professionals who are knowledgeable and aware of these issues and can dialogue with the family and reassure you, no, this really isn't the emergence of an illness. This is something that you have to monitor. And 2 minutes. And God willing, you know, no tragedy. But, you know, some people who have faced those circumstances lose their children. They die. I go into my office every Monday, literally every Monday, and I get the overdoses from the weekend, and the kids who are in the hospital and who are in intensive care, and every once a month or so, there's a dead child. That's a lot of children. So you pray that it never happens to you that way. And if you begin to see patterns, you don't turn your back and say, well, you know, everybody does that. That's the Monitoring the Future study that says, you know, everyone does this, okay. It is not okay. Seek professional help. And there are those in the community who really do begin to understand medical issues like this, and they're the ones. If I could answer in 1 second,
yeah,
in 1 minute.
Yeah, I just want to make a statement very quickly.
Please.
As an ex-smoker and also about the Shuva, so I used to smoke before I became from, and coming graduating from university, I also used to drink. And I immediately thought when I entered into yeshiva that I would be ostracized smoking and drinking. And I think it's a problem not just society, but in the from community globally. That when I entered into yeshiva, smoking was not a problem. Halachically, like now, I've been not smoking for 5 years, I don't understand how someone could smoke. But like you said, the problem is that this room isn't filled. So in yeshiva, the only time drinking was confronted was when a boy absolutely had a problem, and then it was this boy had a problem with drinking, not the yeshiva. And every time I go to Brooklyn, Williamsburg, Crown Heights, Israel, Meir Sharim, Geula, you will see, in my opinion, 7 out of 10 bearded men smoking cigarettes. You come out of Shul Motzi Shabbos, and there's men waiting outside before they even go home for Abdullah with a cigarette waiting. And that's really the way I see the massive problem. So you're trying, and I don't have children yet, because they're Hashem, but you know, everyone is trying to get their children to stop preemptively, but globally, I mean, being from and smoking is not a problem, and I don't understand it. And drinking is not a problem, but it's only when it gets out of hand.
You're not allowed to harm your body. It is a problem, halachically.
Of course.
But, you know, this is a science that hasn't caught up to public policy, and it will. 50 years from now, there's going to be a different dialogue, God willing, and we're going to manage it differently. But it's not alcohol and it's not nicotine. It's alcohol, nicotine, and pot, and now alcohol, nicotine, and prescription drugs. And now as you create that kind of environment, our community will be as much ravaged by the pandemic of substance abuse as any other community, because we're no longer insular anymore. We're connected to a worldwide web, and it seeps into Yaakov's tents. So please be vigilant. And thank you so much for coming out, because you're going to go back and speak to your sister-in-law and your friend and your neighbor and in the synagogues, in the yeshiva, and you're going to speak and ask for policy, and you're going to ask for dialogue, and you're going to make it safe. And when it's safe, we'll make a difference. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.